Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
We have a country that is literally falling apart. We have a country that can't get anything done. Nobody trusts each other. The dialogue is toxic. If you like things the way they are, if you like things to be terrible, then yes, let's make it really hard to vote. Let's make it even harder so we can have even more misery. But if you don't think that the country is working the way that it should, and I certainly don't, something has to change in a radical way. And what we're trying to do is just leverage technology that already exists. You already do more complicated things on your phone every day.
Hey, everybody. We are coming back to you with an awesome show today. This is a direct follow-up with our conversation with Andrew Yang that came on Tuesday that was tied to his new book, Forward, Notes on the Future of American Democracy. That episode was all about how Andrew thinks things in this country have gotten so bad that the only thing we can do is enact major systemic change through the venue and the avenue of a third party, leading to open primaries and ranked choice voting. Today's guest is also fitting in this theme. He believes we need major systemic change to fix America's political death spiral. At least that's what many people, ourselves included, often feel. Our guest is Bradley Tusk. Now, people who are in Andrew Yang world have probably heard of Bradley before. He was a consultant to Andrew's mayoral campaign earlier this year. He was the campaign manager for Michael Bloomberg in 2009, has had all sorts of different involvements in the political space. But interestingly, to the fact that this show covers a bunch of different spaces and topics, he's also a venture capitalist. He works and leads Tusk Ventures. He's notable for having actually been one of the initial people who pioneered Uber's strategy to get around the really, really harsh regulatory picture that a lot of us were seeing there. We'll talk about this a bit on the episode, but it's easy to have beef with Uber now. But for those of us who were in DC back in 2014, we are definitely very appreciative to Bradley's efforts to make it so that we could actually use credit cards when we tried to get to different parts of the city. But Sagar, what is his actual idea that we came in and talked about, and what did you think of it?
Bradley's all about mobile voting. And I got to admit, I was skeptical of Bradley. I mean, ran Mike Bloomberg's campaign, worked for Chuck Schumer, seemed somebody who would be ideologically opposed. But we start off from the same place, which is that American democracy actually is broken, is that the current system is terrible at solving problems. What I love about what he's saying is he's trying to advance something which really would not necessarily benefit his political ideology. And he's very open about that. He's like, look, I want it to be left-right. I just want people to get more involved, which would at least change something. Change the incentives, mobile voting, 70 to 80% turnout. It would change everything in terms of the incentives that people who would vote in primaries, the people who would vote, and which would then change how legislators themselves behaved in Washington. And hey, look, I'm all about that idea. It's exactly what Andrew was trying to get at with ranked choice voting. This is an even more radical and actually more plausible solution, very likely, Marshall.
Yeah, what's interesting about it, to make it very clear for everyone, is he wants to increase efforts to make it so that you can vote with your phone, vote electronically. And this is the type of thing where normally we would put this in the category of startup delusional things, but they've actually done this in multiple states. They've done this in West Virginia. They've done this in Washington. So if you have beef with this idea, like we open that, like that's what we're here for, but right. This has been like something
soldiers have voted,
but it's actually been tried. Right. And what he's done is he's put $10 million into further grants to further address the cybersecurity issues or concerns there. So we get it all of the skepticism, but it's just interesting because the underlying idea that he's putting forth, that once again, want to know what people think, he thinks the only way we could break political dysfunction is we reduce the friction of voting. He has an interesting answer where he says, hey, what was Uber? It reduced the friction of actually getting around a city. He thinks that same idea of making it easier to vote will improve the system that way. A lot of great stuff here. We are sure there'll be plenty we disagree and agree on here. Now, of course, if you are new here, you should definitely check out our Substack. It is coming out a little later today because it's Thursday. There'll be a lot of really interesting comment there. We were going to pull a couple comments that people put on the Andrew Yang episode that were interesting. Lots of good stuff. Bradley has a book. It's called The Fixer. It's all about his different adventures in the startups, tech, and politics spaces. And most importantly, we also have a bookshop where you can purchase anything you want to learn there. Huge thank you, of course, to Lincoln Network for supporting the podcast. Let's get into the episode. Bradley Tusk, welcome to The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Brad.
Hey, sir.
A good place to start would be your diagnosis of the state of the American political system today, because we're obviously going to talk about mobile voting, systemic changes, but just getting a temperature check of the state of our politics is the best.
Yeah, place to start. I mean, I don't think I'm going to say anything that the listeners don't already know and probably agree with, but look, the fact that we right now have one party that controls both chambers of Congress and the White House, and we still can't pass anything, right? Even though there's desperate need for a lot of this stuff. I mean, to me, it's like that sums it up perfectly, which is we are so dysfunctional and we are so divisive and we are so polarized, and we have a country that there's really two key problems, right? Key problem one is we can't actually solve our substantive problems because we can't compromise or pass anything. Problem two, everybody hates each other and nobody trusts each other. And I think while that may be, you know, particularly acute in Washington, I think generally speaking, people have kind of become very tribal and, you know, align with their party or whatever it is, and don't just support the views that they hold, but then really dislike the other side and distrust them. And so, you know, I think that not only is our politics broken, but in many ways, you know, our civil discourse and our society is too.
You know, it's what's interesting, Bradley, is that I have observed that increased tribalism has created two things. One, it's ramped up the people who are engaged within the system, but it's actually even more pernicious because it actually makes people actively tune out. As in, people just say, you know what? I'm done. I don't want to be involved in politics. I'll come pay attention like 2 weeks in, but whatever else this nonsense is happening, I'm not into it. Yeah. This is part of what I like a little bit about your project about increasing voter participation, is that that may be the only way to actually shock the system into something new. Tease us how, look, also give people maybe a little bit of your background. How did you come to this conclusion? Like, why this?
So,
why
is it this? I gotta get both school together. So the first part of my career, I worked directly in government politics. So I was Mike Bloomberg's campaign manager, ran for mayor. I worked for him at City Hall. I was the deputy governor of Illinois for 4 years. I was Chuck Schumer's communications director in Washington. So I kind of saw government and politics from city government, state, federal, worked in the legislative branch, the executive branch, ran campaigns. So got a pretty good perspective on all of it. And the thing that I took away from it is every policy output is the result of a political input. 99% of elected officials, in my experience, desperately need the affirmation and validation that comes with holding office. It fills a hole in their psyche and makes them somebody. Not only does it make them bad, and it's just human nature. And my guess is if you look back at the Greek Senate or the Roman Senate, they were probably the exact same way, right? This is who runs for office. And we have a system where, you know, we constantly expect them to go against their own political self-interest to do the right thing. And of course, that never happens, right? So like, let's take guns as an example. You're a congressman from Florida, you're called a Republican. Turnout in your primary is 12%, and the district is gerrymandered, which they all are. So the only election that matters is that primary. You probably know intellectually that it's fucking crazy. Am I allowed to curse on here?
Of course.
Yeah. That someone can walk into a store and walk out with an AK-47. Like, I don't know what rational mind that's not crazy. But here's what you also know. Turnout's 12% in your next primary, and NRA members make up half that 12%, you are not voting for an assault weapon ban because you will lose your next primary.
Yeah, you'll be destroyed.
Right. But let's say in that same primary, turnout were 40 or 50%. Just based on all of the polling around assault weapons, your vote would flip, and you have to be for an assault weapon ban simply because that's what the majority of your voters would want. And so to me, politicians will do whatever they need to do to stay in office. They'll move left, they'll move right, they'll move to the middle. And we've just got to give them different inputs and incentives. So then the next step of my kind of career was I got into tech, and I kind of pivoted into tech was I'm the guy that either you can thank me or hate me for this, but I ran all the campaigns to legalize Uber and ride sharing around the US. And the thing that we figured out that I think really ultimately resonated with me on voting is we turned our customers into political advocates for the app, right? Over a period of a couple of years, a couple of million people emailed, tweeted, texted, in some way told their elected officials, hey, I want this thing. And by them doing that, we won in every single jurisdiction in the United States. And I remember thinking at the time, two things. One, I bet most of these people never vote like in a municipal primary. And two, imagine if we could vote this way sort of through an app. Clearly, people would be pretty engaged because I'm seeing it in real life. I then became a venture capitalist and kind of repeated the process with FanDuel and Bird and some other companies that we've invested in. And then as both the cloud technology and the blockchain technology kept improving, we kind of hit a point by 2018 where the notion of, you know, trying out that technology in elections didn't seem totally crazy. And so started in West Virginia. The Secretary of State there, named Mac Warner, is a conservative Republican, but was in the military. All four of his kids are in the military. And he had always felt that it was really fundamentally unfair that soldiers would cast their ballot from Kandahar or wherever. It would show up 3 weeks after Election Day and get thrown in the trash. And the people who are literally risking their lives to protect our right to vote, their votes don't even count. So he was looking for a solution to that problem specifically. And so we said, look, we think that, you know, maybe they could vote on their phone and the votes would be instantaneous and not, you know, take a couple of weeks. And so we paid for a pilot program in West Virginia. We're deployed military from two different counties. We're able to participate in that, those elections. It was 28 midterms on their phones. Worked, increased it to 24 counties in the general election. Worked, and then in the intervening time have now done 20 elections in seven different states. Some red, so you know, Utah, West Virginia, South Carolina, some blue, Oregon, Washington, Delaware, and Colorado is, I guess, kind of purplish. And we've either made it available to deploy military or people with disabilities. So we've kind of found one group on the right that no one can object to and one group on the left that no one can object to. And we funded all of the elections out of my foundation. The other part to the story is that when I worked for Uber, I took my fee in equity, and that was really early in the company's history and gave me a lot of independence and freedom to do whatever I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So far, so good. So the good news is we have now, like I said, run 20 elections. They've all been independently audited by the National Cybersecurity Center, all come back clean. Turnout on average has doubled. So that's the good news. Bad news is, the cyber community itself is very split on mobile voting, and they feel like the apps that are currently in use are insufficient from a security standpoint. I don't know that they're right, because we've done it 20 times successfully, but the conclusion I reached was I have to have consensus that whatever we're using is completely secure and safe, because if I can't, I'll never get this thing off the ground. Because what I really have to do is pass legislation in all 50 states, yeah, allowing everyone to vote on their phone. And if you were a group that benefits from the status quo, right? If you're the NRA, like we mentioned on the right, or the NAA on the left, because it's the same thing on both sides, and disproportionately low turnout primaries benefits you, you're going to oppose mobile voting, but you can't say, I don't want more people to vote. I mean, even Republican legislators, and by the way, I've picked on Republicans a bit, but I'm independent at this point. So if you think I hate your favorite party, I do. You know, but even those legislators in Georgia or Texas, they don't say, I don't want black people to vote. They talk about security and all kinds of other stuff. And so I realized I had to take that off the table. So out of my foundation, Tusk Philanthropies, we announced this a couple of days ago, so the timing here is good. We're investing $10 million in grants to the election security community to build new mobile voting technology that is end-to-end encrypted and verifiable, and working in concert with a new group at Berkeley called the Standards Working Group, headed up by former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, of leading cryptographers, cybersecurity experts, academics, where they will say, these are the standards that we think a secure mobile voting system should have. And then the grants that we're giving out are to then be built in accordance with those standards. And so once that's done, and hopefully a year to 18 months, we'll make it open source. We'll give it away for free to governments in the U.S., abroad, to voting technology companies, anybody who wants to use it.
Hmm. So here's the part where the way you told your personal history is very helpful. So this, if this was 2014, we're at the height of tech has good relations with the rest of American society, we'd say something cringe like, well, this is just like Uber for voting. That's great. Like, Bradley, like, interesting. But over the past several years, as we're looking at the post-Iowa caucus, obviously with how disastrous the app played out in the Democratic primary. And then you're looking at how politicized voting became, A, if you're with the point you were making around civil rights issues of voting, but B, with issues around election security and the perception of corruption, whether or not that's there or not. It's obviously not. I don't. Dominion has a variety of things to say on that subject. Can you just talk about how the conversation around voting has become incredibly partisan in a way that it wouldn't have been 5 years ago?
Yeah. And one quick caveat on the Iowa caucus app, it was a reporting app, not a voting app. And we told them not to do it.
Could you talk about that
first? Yeah. So we were dealing with the DNC. And again, I hate your favorite party. So I don't like the Democrats anymore than I like the Republicans, because the Alaska Democratic Party wanted to offer mobile voting in their presidential primary. And Alaska's a really good argument for it, which is people have to get like on a bush plane to be able to vote. Like, it is a really remote place. So it's the kind of place where if you do have connectivity, it makes a lot of sense. So we started engaging with the party, you know, all of their internal cybersecurity people, which are not the high, you know, it's not exactly Facebook or Google over there, right? Said, no, we don't trust this thing. So they didn't let us do it. And at the same time, they're like, oh, we're doing this instead. We're like, that actually sounds like a terrible idea, what you're talking about. And what they had was like a bunch of like political hacks who never really run a tech company put together this app. And of course it didn't work. So the entire country is,
right.
Yeah, right. So, you know, so that's what happened there. But, you know, you're right. And I would say the last sort of 5 to 8 years has made our job both harder and more necessary. So harder because, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, the state of American politics feels like the worst it's ever been, right? In terms of polarization, in terms of dysfunction, in terms of distrust. So people don't trust anyone or anything, right? So therefore, whereas in 2014, Google and Facebook and Uber had really high public images, and now that's not the case at all anymore. You could have said this is Uber for voting, and it really would have worked, whereas now you can't say that. So trust in tech companies has fallen. Obviously, relations with China and Russia have only gotten worse in that period of time. North Korea, Iran. So concerns that people will have, that I think, are valid until we address them from a security standpoint around hacking risk. And then, of course, the 2020 election, January 6th, the subsequent kind of voting changes that we've seen in some of the southern states like Texas and Georgia. You put all that together, it's a really difficult climate. But at the same time, and there was a poll and study done by the University of Virginia recently, I don't know if you guys saw it, where people started to talk about the notion of like, maybe we shouldn't be one country anymore. And I've been thinking about this for a long time, which is if we don't do something like mobile voting that fundamentally changes the inputs and incentives that politicians have to move them to the middle, to tone down the temperature and to start getting things done, I don't think we stay as one country. Because if you think about it in terms of like a divorce, there comes a point, sounds like half of American couples reach this point, so it's not uncommon, of our differences are so severe and so irreconcilable and our trust is so non-existent that we are better off separately, right? And I think that that's kind of where we're headed, absent some sort of radical fix to the way that we vote and the way we run democracy.
Bradley, can you return to the story of Uber? I think this is very important. I actually lived in Washington, D.C. at the time. I was a college student, and I remember getting that message.
That was the first one we ever did, first campaign.
I know, and I read about this, but it's fascinating because I read it as an analyst, and I was a participant. And I was like, wait. I was like, I hate the taxis. I'm like, they never want to take your credit cards. They don't want to pick you up. They're absolute monsters. It'd be like, they only, you know, will come in
this
particular...
And all the zone
particular
stuff in D.C. is weird, and they make you share. And then they charge you for the whole ride. Yeah,
it was like, it was a disaster. And I was a very early adopter of Uber, and I got that message, and I was like, hell no, the city council is not going to take away Uber. Right. This is a very powerful kind of validation of what you're talking about. I lived in D.C. I was literally, I was like 19 or 20 years old when it was happening. Yep. I had no idea who the D.C. city councilman was, nothing. But I did, in the Uber app, send my email. And I was like, as a DC resident, I was like, there's no way you're going to take this away. So it did work. Talk about the lesson of the engagement that you saw on that particular issue. And I know this may be cringe, sorry, just to expound a little bit, given, you know, the whatever happened with Uber after, but people need to remember how terrible taxis actually were.
For sure, and because my publisher gets mad when I don't do this, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Fixer. There's a bunch of chapters about this in there. If you're interested in it, you can pick up a copy. Mm-hmm. So let's take the point that I made at the opening of the podcast, which is every policy output is the result of a political input. I firmly believe that. So let's say you're an average city council member in D.C. or Philly or Newark or wherever, anywhere, right? All things being equal, if you're getting money from the taxi owner's campaign money and they're employing lobbyists who are helpful to you politically, you're going to do what they want because you're just saying, what is best for my next reelection? And it's like, okay, take care of the donors. Why not? And the only thing that changed that was they're used to hearing from like a couple of hundred people on an issue. And all of a sudden, thousands or sometimes tens of thousands of emails or texts or tweets are flooding into their office saying, I'm a registered voter in your district and I want this thing to stay. And it had the exact same impact in every single part of this country, which was, holy shit, I didn't realize I was poking this incredible sleeping bear. I don't need any part of this. Fine. And it literally worked the same way just about. We had slightly different campaigns in different jurisdictions, but when you boil down to it, it really just was rinse and repeat. And it worked because fundamentally, politicians do whatever they think will help them the most or hurt them the least in the next election. When it was about, you know, when there was no risk and they could just take care of their donors and taxi, that was the politically logical thing to do. When all of a sudden we had 10,000 of their voters show up, then not doing what taxi wanted was the logical thing to do. FanDuel is another good example of this. You know, it was the first investment we ever made out of my first venture fund. And we were running all of these campaigns around the US to legalize daily fantasy sports betting. I remember we had some meetings, like this one was in Florida, like a state rep, and he said, look, let's be honest. The people who play FanDuel and DraftKings, they don't know who you are. They may not even know what a state rep is, right? Let's not pretend that our customers are like engaged voters. However, they fucking love this thing. And if you take it away from them, we were to make sure they know who you are, and we're going to make sure they're registered, and we're going to make sure they're turned out. And you know what almost every single politician said? No problem. Fine. I could care less about fantasy sports either way. I don't need this headache. And so ultimately, to me, that's the validation that you were just talking about, which is and why I'm just put $10 million of my own money into this mobile voting project, because I truly believe that they just follow the inputs, whatever they are. And if you shift the inputs, you shift the outputs. And if we get outputs that then move people towards, hey, climate change is a real thing. We need to deal with it, or immigration, or guns, or education, whatever it is. Then I think we could A, have progress, and B, you know, not dissolve as a union. Mm-hmm.
There's a, I don't want to say slight contradiction, but you've said some things which don't quite line up that are actually interesting in their implications. Yeah. In the sense that, for example, as you said, when you were describing the Uber campaign at the start, those people didn't vote. And Sagar, I know for a fact, I was there in D.C. with you. You didn't vote either. So as you're articulating this, it seems to me, from a shorter term perspective, isn't there just a case for pouring a lot of money into apps, processes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that better catalog how the public actually perceives topics, and then using that energy to translate on act. So for, because in your example, you made clear, none of these people are actually voting. So how does what you're describing actually tie to the efforts at increasing participation in the actual elections themselves?
Yeah. So I think, look, to me, the answer would be no, because ultimately, like, think about in tech, why did Uber succeed? It reduced the friction of getting a taxi, right? You used to have to wave your hand and hope they would stop. And, you know, if you're a person of color, often they didn't stop, even if they were free, all these things happen. And then all of a sudden you could press a button and you got it, right? And as a result, I remember when we had our first kind of big valuations, all these academics saying, that's impossible. The whole U.S. taxi market's only $12 billion. How could Uber be worth $16 billion? And Travis's point, he was right, was I'm going to grow the market considerably, because I'm taking an unpleasant thing and I'm making it a pleasant thing. So I truly believe that when you reduce friction, you increase adoption dramatically. Or we're investors in a men's health company called Roe, and the Roe's first product was erectile dysfunction. And the thing that they realized was a lot of men who might want to be able to use a product like Viagra are too embarrassed to ask their doctor for it. If you can reduce the friction because you can now do it over text as opposed to in person or even over video, more people ask for it. And that's exactly what happened. So I think that if we make voting available online, we take out all the friction, people will do it. I think there have been a lot of efforts, Marshall, for both academics and GOTV organizations and to say, okay, how do we catalyze the issues and tell people how important they are and run all these get out to vote campaigns? And look, in a presidential election, that can work, right? We actually don't have a turnout problem in presidential elections. But what I'm really concerned about is a city council primary, a state senate primary. You know, all of these elections, you know, Marshall, you're a New Yorker. Bill de Blasio, who I would argue has been a totally failed mayor, won both of his primaries with roughly 300,000 votes in each of them. That equates to about 4% of the New York City population. And that was effectively who elected him. So, you know, no surprise that we then had a disaster at City Hall for the last 8 years. So it seems to me that you're just never going to get the kind of participation that would be meaningful to change the inputs, absent anything other than mobile voting, which is, so I know you had Andrew on last week, and obviously, you know, we're close with Andrew, and he's promoting the Final Five concept right now. I'm sure he talked about that on the podcast. I'm for Final Five, for top two, for open primaries, redistricting reform. I'm for all of it. However, it seems to me those are all incremental, right? Because they still require someone to do something that they clearly don't want to do. And mm-hmm. the only thing that I can think of that fundamentally is different is mobile voting. Because at this point, somewhere between 80 and 90% of American adults have smartphones. It's no longer sort of a luxury. It's kind of a utility. I mean, you even literally see homeless people with smartphones. Which is good. So people have access to it. Plus, we're not shutting down all the other ways of voting. We're just introducing another option. And so, to me, this is the only thing that has a chance of working.
I love that you said what you just said about the problems with the incrementalist approach, because once again, states like California have had some version of the reforms that Andrew has talked about, and they haven't actually change the dynamics in the states. I don't think anyone could look at California, which has had a certain version of open primaries for over 10 years, and think people are now doing solutions now.
And
so to your point,
redistricting. They did both. Exactly. I mean, exactly. Schwarzenegger has great credit, by the way. He did both. And I thought that was wonderful. But like, the impact has been incremental at best.
Minimal, right.
So the key point is, what you're really saying here is, unless you actually increase the number of people participating, it doesn't really matter if you shift around those little parts here. But let me just, because look, there's a conservative part of our audience which is very mad at us right now. I'll just ask this as plainly as possible. What do you say to people? Because you see these people on Facebook, social media all the time now who just say, look, there's something sacred and special about voting. We should just have paper ballots. We should wait in line. Yes, like the law about not passing out water is ridiculous, but at a core level, aside from those marginal type of policy changes, we should just make this process very rigorous. What do you say to them? Because they're definitely listening right now.
I think that that's basically what we have right now. We have a country that is literally falling apart. We have a country that can't get anything done. Nobody trusts each other. The dialogue is toxic. And so, if you like things the way they are, if you like things to be terrible, then yes, let's make it really hard to vote. Let's make it even harder so we can have even more misery. But if you don't think that the country is working the way that it should, and I certainly don't, something has to change in a radical way. And what we're trying to do is just leverage technology that already exists. You already do more complicated things on your phone every day. You shop, you do your banking, you get healthcare. You know, things that are actually a lot more complicated than pressing. Like, think about if, I don't know if you guys are sports fans, but like you go to ESPN.com, who do you think should be the NL Cy Young? Pick Jacob DeGrom or whoever it is. That's all mobile voting is. Now, it's on the blockchain, so it provides, you know, there's a lot more security for how the vote is transmitted, but it is conceptually incredibly simple, right? And so I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I'm trying to take something that people do all day, every day, and make one more function available.
You know, Bradley, part of the problem, this is going to be my most like center left lib take here, which is that what are we doing in a non-fact based world? So, for example, Dominion voting conspiracy was obviously bullshit.
Yes.
And you are, look, to your credit, you're going to these great lengths, cybersecurity experts, you know, and trying to validate the actual mechanics of this. But here's what I discovered. 60-something million people literally don't give a shit. As long as Trump says the election was stolen, they believe it. What do we do in that scenario? And then, yeah, like you're saying, people have to respond to that incentive. And I'm look, I mean, you are a legitimate independent. I absolutely believe that. But if they're going to see mobile voting in an election turn, you know, let's say it turns out in a Democrat's favor in a particular state, they're going to be like, oh, it was rigged. You know, how do we deal with that?
Yeah. So look, there's a certain number of black helicopter conspiracy theorists that, you know, you're not going to convince. And by the way, that's true on both sides of the aisle.
Of course. Yeah, right.
And keep in mind, the first state to do mobile voting was West Virginia, which is among the most Republican states in the country. And the reason they liked it is because their view is people in the military vote Republican, right? And so we were actually empowering and growing a Republican voting base, right, and constituency. And so, there are some people that will never trust any form of technology or that will just never trust any sort of system. And I get that. Look, as a venture capitalist, I spent all day trying to disrupt things, right? So I play into that lack of trust all the time based on the investment decisions that I make, right? I'm betting that people's dissatisfaction with the current banking system will lead enough of them to invest in cryptocurrency to make Coinbase a good investment for us, which luckily it was. Those types of things are happening all day long. But fundamentally, the reason that people are so upset is because things never get better, right? They're constantly promised change. And if you think about it, like, Obama promised to be a transformative president. And I think, you know, he's as talented and decent as they come, but he wasn't, right? He passed one bill on a straight party line and really didn't accomplish anything else for the next 8 years. And I read his 900-page biography to see if that was wrong. And I didn't really conclude anything different after I was done with it. Or Donald Trump, you know, obviously controversial, but again, different for sure, right? Nobody would disagree with that. He passed one tax bill. And that's it. Nothing else happened. And again, that was on a straight Republican Party vote. And so, you know, people keep being promised by politicians, I'm going to come in and change everything. I'm so different. I'm going to save you. The Biden promise was, I'm so normal that the problem is Trump. But Biden can't pass anything either. He's a, I would like him to be effective, but he has not been so far. I don't know who could argue that he has been. So fundamentally, people feel lied to. They feel like they're not heard. And yes, there are always still going to be people who don't participate or don't like it or whatever it is. But I really think that the best way to restore faith in government and some of the institutions we have in society is to show people that these institutions can actually work. And if they can function and work, I think you will restore faith. And if they can't, I think we end up breaking up into multiple countries.
I'm reading this really interesting book to honestly prep for this episode, but leads into the themes here. It's called The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Reform Their Democracy. For the publisher doing this for them, 1865 to 1914. And the point that the book makes, it's by a curator at the Smithsonian. The author makes the point that that period after the Civil War was actually one of the most participatory periods in American political history. But at the same time, like, our politics were incredibly fractious. You had these huge set of issues. The point that I'm getting at is, it doesn't seem to me to be a given that increasing participation leads to moderation and problem solving. So can you correct the record on what you're articulating there?
So it's funny. No one ever asked me this question, but I always kind of expect to get it. So I'm glad that someone finally did. American politics has always been acrimonious, right? Like, if you look back at sort of the 1700s, 1800s, and the pamphlets, they were pretty brutal too. However, I think this little thing called the internet changed everything, right? And, you know, you could have a certain amount of, you know, partisan fighting, and yet it was still possible that when U.S. senators got to Washington, that they could kind of shut things out and say, okay, let's figure out how to get this done or that done. And they did, right? You had if you take sort of from FDR through to, like, call it Kennedy, like, a lot, or Johnson, they got a lot done, right? You might agree with some of it, disagree with others, but, like, federal government did quite a bit, right? And so it still was possible, even with the acrimony, to compromise, because right now, if you're an elected official, and you even show a hint of compromising, there's all of a sudden, you know, let's say you're on the left and you're a Democrat and MSNBC is beating the shit out of you and Twitter's kicking the crap out of you and AOC is criticizing you, and you very, very quickly retreat because you don't want to take that kind of pounding, right? And that's true on both sides of the aisle. So the internet has made it so much worse that in a weird way, the only thing that could solve the problem the internet created is the internet itself.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating to think about it that way, which is that engagement doesn't necessarily reduce acrimony, but there does seem to be something particularly unique about our current primary system, especially in the House of Representatives and the Senate, which does seem fundamentally at least different from that period, I guess, you know, because I see both sides of the argument. What are some other, do you think, social pathologies and more that could come from increased participation via mobile voting?
Let's see. Arguably, so if you take a well-functioning city government, of which there are certainly some, by and large, because once the mayor is elected, you know, she or he usually has the power to typically run the city. Not at all cities, but in these strong mayors. You could argue that the more people are voting in city council primaries, mayoral primaries, and the more aware they are, the more that they're going to really start kind of questioning all the things that City Hall is doing. And maybe that mucks up the operations in some way. Although, you know, look, I worked for Mike Bloomberg at City Hall. There's no kind of bigger mayoralty than New York City, I think, in the world. And there's no mayor that gets more press attention than the mayor of New York City. So, you know, we were dealing with stuff 24/7 and still managed to run the government reasonably well. And so, you know, I don't know that that's going to really create a new pathology. I think what I'm sure we'll have is endless accusations of election fixing and hacking and, oh, my candidate lost, the same stuff that Trump did. Because yes, China hacked into the system and did that. And so, yeah, I mean, what I'm proposing is not easy by any means. It's going to be hard. I just don't see a way out of our current predicament without it. Mm-hmm.
The funny thing of what you just said is you're kind of making the case. Well, you're obviously making the case because you get the cyber hacking accusations, whether or not you pass this bill or not, right, which is actually right, a really depressing point, because we're like, it's not your thing, but what happens if everyone loses? Right. You're like, well, that's happening anyways. But so this is my last social pathology question, because I said this to Andrew and I wasn't quite satisfied with his answer. Here's what I see happening in the scenario you're describing, because once again, you're basically saying that we have a set of politicians who are operating under the current outputs. But I also think as part of the toxicity problem that Sagar is describing, a certain type of person is attracted to the political system right now. So for example, shit talked him before, I'll shit topic him again. Madison Cawthorn actually was built for this current system in the sense that it's not like Madison Cawthorn doesn't actually want to go and legislate and work hard. He actually just wants to vibe and do Turning Point USA conferences. So Madison Cawthorn and politicians like him are not going to take these changes, aka increased participation, moderation, the right way. But let's say it passes. So I'm not saying they stop it, but it passes. What I see them doing is in those primaries, they work even harder to turn out their far right or far left bases. They say there is this centrist, neoliberal, whatever assault on pro-life people, right, pro-gun voters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that actually will just be such a driver of turnout, but that will still overwhelm the system. What do you think about that scenario?
Yeah, a few things. So one is, yes, that will happen. But two, ironically, the party that benefited the most from the internet from a turnout and organized standpoint was the Republicans, right?
Yeah.
The Tea Party was created by Facebook. In fact, not that Mark Zuckerberg sat there and created it, but the technology is what enabled it. Before that, organizing and GOTV and all that was a Democratic stronghold because they had institutions like labor unions that had the mechanisms to do this. All of a sudden, when you could do a lot of this on the internet, Republicans had the ability to kind of, you know, fight back. And they organized and obviously, you know, even if I don't like what they've done with it, they've done a lot politically. They've certainly, you know, run with it. So I would say to Madison, like, I actually think that if you look at the history of your own party, this isn't so bad for you. Right. And look, if some far left or far right candidate is so effective at turning out their voters online that they win a particular election, great, that's democracy. I have no problem
politics
with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I, you know, I'm not trying to only ensure the election of centrists. I'm just trying to ensure that whatever the mainstream wants is the incentive that the politicians have typically to do something. And so, you know, I think that that's how you kind of see it. But I'll also just give you like, it is like my brother-in-law is a congressman named Josh Gottheimer, who's been in the news a bit lately.
Oh, Mr. Salt. Yeah.
You know, I talk to Josh actually these days kind of daily because what he's dealing with. And, you know, this is someone who doesn't need the job, was making millions of dollars a year before he went to Congress, is genuinely trying to get the infrastructure bill done and get something done. And all he hears is just endless complaints, endless criticism. He gets the shit kicked out of him by his own party. Every time he has an event, he's protested by the far left, by the DSA and the Justice Dems and the Working Families Party and others. And like, we're just, the system we have is making it just, even when someone really does want to try to do the right thing, it makes it virtually impossible. And so, you know, yes, could two really smart guys like you come up with 25 arguments as to how mobile voting could in some way backfire or create, you know, have unexpected negative externalities? Sure. However, here's what I know. The system is broken. It's getting even worse. And only a radical change is going to fix it.
I completely agree with all that. It's funny. I've been trying to tell people in the GOP, I'm like, you guys do realize with education polarization and more non-voters coming into the system, you would dramatically benefit, you know, just given the trends. But, you know, now, who am I? Just some guy with a
podcast. That said, I do think that the opposition will come across the board. So take Chuck Schumer, right, who I used to work for. Even if Chuck believed that overall mobile voting would help effectuate some of the kind of more mainstream policies that he cares about, he would be terrified that, you know, AOC would primary him next year, and that she wouldn't know how to use the internet in a way that he couldn't, and he would lose as a result. So I think people who are in power on both sides of the aisle are going to fight like hell to protect their power and protect the system, the status quo. So it's you know, we're going to get this across the board.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting, Bradley, we are talking to you right after we just talked with Andrew Yang. What are some of the lessons of the Yang, you know, mayoral race, which you were involved in?
Yeah.
The part of the broader political project, just everything. It's been a couple of months now for you to
reflect. Yeah, no, it's a great question. I don't think anyone has actually asked me for sort of thoughts around that since. So it's something that's interesting to talk about. So number one, I think, is we experienced everything that the three of us have been talking about for the last 40 minutes or all we've been talking, in the sense of Andrew Yang, who is effectively, now he's independent, but an incredibly progressive person who literally kind of brought the universal basic income movement to life, all of a sudden became this sort of enemy of the left, enemy of the New York Times. And not only did he get the shit kicked out of him in the press for the entire campaign, I got the shit kicked out of me. The Times did a front page hit job on me. I was just a consultant. And I still got beaten up because, you know, of Uber or, you know, the fact that I, you know, support law enforcement or whatever else. So one is everything that we talk about here, we experienced in real time in the campaign itself. Two, what I found to be especially distressing was the far left and the media could be anti-Asian or anti-Semitic, and that was somehow okay. Right. Mm-hmm. So a lot of there was a cartoon of Andrew in the Daily News that had him with slanted eyes and buck teeth.
I remember this. Yeah.
Can you imagine if someone from any other race had that? And the Daily News didn't even apologize. They defended themselves. Right. You know, what, just because they're Asian, you can beat up on them? Or like the Times profile of me basically said, you know, rich, you know, shadowy guy lurking in the corner is going to pull all of the strings. And they literally called me the shadow mayor and run the city. And it's like, yeah, that's the same imagery that's been used to persecute Jews. And I'm Jewish for thousands of years. Right. And here you are doing it again. And so the intolerance of the left, and I think it's totally true on the right, I just experienced it in the Yang campaign on the left, to me is like, it's staggering. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, the zeitgeist. So my view going through the campaign, why I thought we would win, is the election was about COVID. The zeitgeist was about recovery. And Andrew, as an entrepreneur who was sort of a business person, was the and kind of a positive cheerleading type figure, was the right person to lead New York City out of the mess. At a certain point, when the vaccines became widely available, people stopped worrying as much about COVID because then they realized they'd be okay even if they got it. Crime hit, right, in a really big way. Shooting skyrocketed, crime skyrocketed, and the zeitgeist of the campaign changed. And Eric Adams, who had been a cop for 22 years, all of a sudden became kind of a logical choice. And you know what? It was sort of, it was happening and it was like we were watching it and knew it and couldn't really do that much about it. And we said all the right things about crime, but it didn't matter because, you know, we weren't going to out-cop the cop, right? And so zeitgeist really just has a tremendous ability to drive absolutely everything. The third, and I hate saying this because I really hate the way that they run the organization now, but the Trump era really empowered the New York Times. Their endorsements were far more impactful and meaningful in this election cycle in New York City than they have been for years and years. Whether it was Catherine Garcia almost winning after getting her endorsement, or Alvin Bragg becoming the Manhattan DA, or Brad Lander winning the public advocates race, or anything else. And so I think in this world where everything is so partisan and so topsy-turvy, the enemy of my enemy, you know, can become my friend. And as a result, when the Times decided that they hated Yang, then every progressive decided they had to hate us too.
Fascinating.
So those are kind of my immediate takeaways.
Yeah.
You know, something that I'm wondering, and this goes to the Yang part, is what are your, just in this last section, your broad thought on how politicians should approach this moment? Because there's this really frustrating moment with Yang on Kara Swisher's podcast, where like Kara like really did not get it, and she was basically trying to sideswipe Yang by saying, "Well, you know," because what happened was people tried to get her to run for mayor of San Francisco, and she's like, "I'm not qualified," and she's slapping Yang by saying, "You weren't qualified either." I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa!" Like, the type of person who could be a successful politician because, like you said, of the internet and media and the fact that we have this huge majority of people who don't like either party or don't like the actual system is going to necessarily change. So to a certain degree, people are not looking for Mr. Red Tie with 50 years in the state legislature, Congress, and the Senate majority. It's not the 1950s. So that's just me. I was so annoyed when Kara said that, because it actually just shows that she doesn't understand. This goes to the New York Times point. And, please.
And interestingly, like, Mike Bloomberg also had never worked in government and had no specific qualifications. He was really good. And that's a lot of the reason I thought Andrew would be good, because I think a lot of the principles that Mike had were things that, you know, Andrew would have advanced. And by the way, because I talked to Kara when she was thinking of running for mayor of San Francisco, and I encouraged her to do it, I think for the same reasons you just said, Marshall, which is we live in a new era where someone who is as charismatic and savvy as she is online, you know, could be really, really effective. She chose not to do it. But nonetheless, I don't think Andrew was unqualified. I don't think Mike was unqualified. And I don't think Kara would have been unqualified had she run.
Who isn't qualified? I just have to, because I'm shilling for my political ideology here, but who in this fractious internet acrimonious moment, who do you think isn't qualified given what we're saying?
So it depends on the office we're talking about. But let's just say that we're talking about an executive branch position, right? So take, I'm picking on him, but he deserves it. Bill de Blasio, can hear him. Before he was mayor, he had a job called public advocate. That is a literally made up job that has no responsibilities, almost no staff, no budget. It's literally just a citywide elected official job to create more patronage. That's what he did for 4 years before becoming a public advocate, before becoming mayor, was a city councilman before that. He had never run anything. He had never accomplished anything in the public sector or the private sector or the nonprofit sector. He was a pure kind of ideologue and talking head. And governing a city like New York is really, really hard. I mean, it was way beyond his skill set. He just wasn't smart enough, hardworking enough, talented enough, anything enough to do the job. And so I would say that people who, especially for executive branch positions, have never run anything, to me, would be kind of the least qualified. But I feel like, Marshall, you have a clear point of view on this. So I'm curious to see what you would say.
Well, I guess all I'm basically getting at is this idea that And once again, this is where there's this interesting, like, I read obviously as like a New York Times listener, reader, et cetera, but it's really interesting seeing established institutions that haven't reckoned with the implications of the decline of trust in what we've talked about, which is, once again, to your point, I am not sure, for example, like, once again, you do not need to comment on her, but I'm not sure that Kamala Harris getting elected in a uniparty blue state is the proper education for governing a fractious country right now. In an opposite way, I think Joe Biden actually spending a trillion years in the Senate during a different era of bipartisanship is actually a useful thing. So I, once again, do not think that there's been enough reckoning with how different the system has been from the norms that we established from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, when it's an entirely different country now. I mean, Sagar, what's your...
Well, no, I completely agree. I mean, look, the obvious future that we see, and I think maybe because all three here were connected to the traditional political system in some way, but also can kind of see where the future is trending, is that it's just clearly not A, what people want, and B, like, qualification doesn't mean anything. I mean, whenever it comes to, like you just pointed out, Marshall, okay, how many tens of millions of votes did Kamala Harris win in California? By that metric, it's like, oh, she received millions of votes. She's somebody who's been tested on the national stage. It's like, no, that's a complete and total joke. And when you test it out on the national political front, it obviously is going to fall apart. I'm absolutely confident that that's what happened if she were to face voters. When I look at it in reality, and Bradley, this is where I'm curious for when you bring your tech perspective into this, because you literally have to see it trying to disrupt and more, is Trump proved, regardless of whether you like him or not, that the way that this is going to be moving forward, Biden being the aberration, is going to be somebody who can leverage, it's not even policy necessarily, it's, I'm not even exactly sure, but it's like the vibe, for lack of a better word, that connects deeply, which is not being covered by these mainstream institutions, which have just lost dramatic amounts of trust with the American people. So I just think that whatever can tap into that, and this is why I'm frankly deeply encouraged by the mobile voting conversation, is because I do really believe that there are a lot of people out there who are completely unrepresented, who have deeply lost faith within the system. I owe my entire career to that, frankly. And I just think that if we could see it, if we could see that manifested in some way, it would change things. Because look, it's nice to have a YouTube show where I talk about that all the time, and you know, it's cool for me, but it's really bad for the country, as you continue to point out, to have so many millions of people just see totally fed up with the system.
And if you look, it has, so completely agree. If you look at really since the 1960s, trust institutions have been plummeting. So over the last 60 years, the government, the church, higher education, Wall Street, you know, the media, right? No one trusts any of that anymore. And as a result, you've seen in other areas the rise of things like cryptocurrency as an alternative to the banking system, or big healthcare institutions like hospitals. People would rather get their care now kind of remotely through, you know, some kind of teledoc appointment. So we've already seen businesses and movements spring up in response to the absence of trust to fill certain voids. I think, in my view, mobile voting is just sort of the next iteration of that. And one that is probably less technically complicated than most of the other stuff that's already happening now. To ask you guys a quick question, just based on what you said. So how worried are you that Biden either can't win re-election or doesn't run for re-election? Harris sort of by default has to be the nominee and Trump just kills her.
Yeah, I think there's probably like a 60% chance that that happens. Maybe higher, honestly. Yeah,
that's on a couple levels, regardless of whether or not you like Trump or not, I think that's the nightmare scenario. I think that a Trump election should be a consensus election. It should be where people can make a resounding decision. And I think Trump versus Pete Buttigieg will be much better for the country than Trump versus Kamala Harris.
Yeah. But with that said, I don't really think Buttigieg is part of their administration. He's probably not going to primary. That who primaries her other than someone from the very far left that would also lose to Trump?
Look, Biden said it. Kamala is going to be the nominee if he doesn't run. So, like, look, man, you made your bed. Like, I don't really know what to tell you. And all those idiots in the DNC who didn't speak harder, or even in the VP selection committee, that's on you. And if
we're
that's
now
what
leaking,
happens,
by the way, all the leakers,
yeah,
now.
We're all leaking. You're like, she's a terrible politician. I'm like, oh, where were you? She didn't even make it to Iowa. Like, what? You don't have eyes? Yeah, no, so, I absolutely think Trump will win if it's Trump versus Kamala Harris. I mean, you know, even I think Biden is literally probably the only person in the entire Democratic Party who could beat him. I've talked with people who think that, you know, they're like, oh, you know, no, there's no way the American people would re-elect Trump again. I'm like, I think you're out of your mind.
They almost did.
Like, yeah, they almost did. He gave 45,000 votes away from winning the presidency.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So then one more question for you guys.
Yeah.
As you guys may know, I host a podcast. Marshall's been a guest.
Yeah,
so
no,
I host a podcast too. So I'm turning the tables a little bit here. But if the what are the odds that the Democrats literally implode and can't pass infrastructure and the spending bill? And if they can't, once we get past this calendar year, is it basically impossible for Biden to get any major legislative wins in Congress?
That's the lesson of the last two presidencies. You said it yourself. Yeah. You get one thing and that's it.
Look,
I think it's done. Whatever does pass, it will be bipartisan infrastructure light. I've been calling it Obamacare 2.0, as in individual elements of the bill, when polled without the political baggage, are absolutely popular. But put through the meat grinder of the system, culture war, partisan, gerrymander, whatever. All, you know, your talking points left and right on top. It's something which will be a political morass. Nobody actually knows what's in it. Even the way that they talk about it, they're like 1.5 trillion, 2 trillion. It's like, okay, yeah, but like for what? Like for what purpose? Even infrastructure itself is being messaged terribly. So I think the Obama people who work for Biden didn't learn anything. But two, yeah, it's quite obvious that the current iteration of the political system can pass something only during the first couple of months of a presidency. And now what we've learned from the last couple of presidencies, only really, really during a dramatic crisis. I think Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was more an aberration than anything else. It also, we should remember, barely happened. And the only reason it really did was because of the broad political consensus within the Republican Party over 25 years. Democrats don't really have their own version of Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So yeah, I mean, it's a perfect illustration of what you're talking about, Bradley, why the political system is dead.
Bradley's been very generous with his time. So let's just ask one closing question, because it's the obvious one people are thinking. Given what you said about needing new institutions that have dealt with the implications of declining trust, people are probably thinking, and I know your thoughts on this because I really enjoy Firewall, which you have not done enough of a job of plugging. It's a very, very excellent podcast, unironically. So, yeah, I was doing show research and I just kept on listening. So like, that's my actual compliment. Why isn't a new third party, and I know what you think about this, but why isn't a new third party that new institution to deal with what you're describing?
So I would love for that to be the case. And in 2016, when Mike was thinking of running for president, I put together a full presidential campaign for him to run as an independent, right? I was, you know, I had ballot access teams ready to go in every state and lawyers and websites and, you know, it's also helped from Bloomberg World with his unlimited money. You can do a lot of stuff. But it is, at the moment at least, because we're in a world that is so tribal, the number of people, so there's a, I guess I don't want to spoil the announcement, there's a prominent person who's going to announce an independent Senate run in the coming days or weeks. Maybe he already has announced it, but I'm talking tomorrow. And my question, you know, over the email back and forth was like, look, if you assume that the Republican has the base and the Democrats have their base, how is there enough votes left to win? If there is, like, I'm in, I'd love to see this happen and I'll give money and raise money and help however I can. But like, you know, the math is really hard. Look, in 2009, when I ran Mike's campaign, he was an independent at that point. We wanted to run as independent for mayor, ended up running as a Republican as well, simply because the math just wasn't there. 45% of the vote goes to the Democratic nominee, no matter who it is. It could be any of the three of us, and we would be that. You guys would get it. You know, not a lot of Republican votes, but 10%, 12%, whatever it is, not enough left for, you know, for someone else. So I'm for it conceptually. And here's, I guess, instead where I think maybe this could happen. It's more realistic, which is not the creation of a really effective third party, but the splintering of the two parties that we have. We're seeing in this internecine kind of civil warfare between Democrats and on the progressive side and the center side right now. But the reality is socialists and centrist Democrats really belong to different parties, right? They have different ideologies, different perspectives. They should be different. And, you know, hardcore Trumpers are different than kind of moderate, more traditional pro-business Republicans. And I think that given that we live in a world that is so, does thrive so much on hate and toxicity, the odds of the party splintering to me are significantly greater than the odds of a third party springing up. But I think it would have the same effect, right? Because all of a sudden, if all of the people on the super far left or far right are no longer in the traditional Democratic and Republican primary voting because they're either a socialist or they're a libertarian, then all of a sudden, you know, that starts to shift the inputs as well, where that moderate Democrat, you know, doesn't have as much political risk in doing a deal with a moderate Republican or vice versa. So I think we can get to that point. I think I just think you're more likely to see it through a splintering than through a fringe.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. Bradley, it's been really great talking to you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for joining us, man.
Yeah, thanks. That was really fun.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.